The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. So today we have had this wonderful opportunity to meditate together on our Meditation Sunday. And also I've been reflecting on the fact that we're approaching the autumn equinox. I think this is made for a very tall person, yes. The autumn equinox, which is on September 23rd. And so I thought I'd combine some of these themes of meditation and what we traditionally reflect on at the autumn equinox, and also teaching on equanimity, which has been an important theme in my training recently. So I'm thinking of talking primarily about equanimity at the equinox. It's, I don't know if you remember, those of you who have been coming here for many, many years, but it used to be a practice here that we would celebrate a feeding of the hungry ghost ceremony, and a sagaki ceremony at the autumn equinox, and in fact in the spring as well, because in Japan it's called Ohigen or Higen-e, and it's a time when it's believed that the spirits of the dead are more easily able to cross over to the other shore of nirvana. So there's the custom, and I guess it's still the case today, not sure, of people tending to clean and decorate the graves of their loved ones at these times. And Reverend Master G used to post a scroll in here, which we still have, but it's rather fragile. It's a beautiful old scroll which she brought from the Far East, of depicting an old man asking a young boy directions on the path, you know, how to find the way. And she felt an important teaching at this time. So apparently it's the custom in Soto Zen Buddhist temples in the Far East to reflect on the opportunities and training presented to us as a result of the equality of day and night at this time of the equinox. So light and darkness being in balance. The word equinox in Latin, I found out, means equal night. And as you probably all know, you know, at this time, the tilt of the Earth's axis is perpendicular to the sun. So the rays of the sun are hitting us directly in an equal manner. And so that's the equality of day and night. And I thought that was a lovely metaphor in itself for the kind of training that we could do at this time, a time perhaps of letting go of clinging to extremes, to the opposites, to entering a path of equanimity, all things being equal. Sitting up straight in the presence of the Buddha, allowing the light to fully enter us. So back to the scroll. The importance of this image is in teaching us how to let go of old opinions. Apparently at this time is the easiest time to do this, letting go of old opinions, old habits. So the old man represents this in the image, things that have kept us stuck in our training, and of the necessity of being willing to learn from anyone or anything in order to cross over to the other shore, in order to let go of our suffering. And Reverend Master Jiu likened this to crossing over from worldliness, worldly thinking, to leading a religious life. So I'd like to talk more about what that actually means to us. Likening the process of changing from summer to winter. So all these things can teach us if we pay attention to what's happening and tune in. So that they say, it's said that the easiest time for this kind of activity are the equinoxes, when things are equal. So I thought we should perhaps make a special point of looking at what we can do. I see it as a time for looking at places, as I mentioned, where we might feel really stuck and seeing how much we might be hanging on to old ideas or opinions, things that might be holding us back in our training, perhaps ideas or opinions that we've picked up along the way, and they can be sometimes quite subtle. We're not aware that we're carrying them, either from childhood, from our education, of the society that we're part of. I'm not saying all opinions are wrong, but just to examine them. Sometimes things, what is thought of as normal in our world, it's good to look at that once in a while. Or from our, you know, things from our karmic inheritance that are just in part of our makeup, and we're not sure where they come from. And I know for me in particular, I have to look at views and opinions I have about myself. Views we have about ourselves can be very subtle and insidious, keeping us going round and round on a negative track, like an old broken record, you know, that feeling. Certainly coming to meditate together today, as we've done, allowing ourselves to be encouraged by this, being together is a very positive step in cutting through the cycle of clinging to old harmful thought patterns. They can give us a false sense of security, you know, how we can feel very kind of secure in our lives until suddenly maybe one of those rays of the sun hits us and we realize, gosh, we're only living in a very small part of what our potential is and of what is really going on. We start to see a little bit of the bigger picture, a bit of the cosmos perhaps, a view into the cosmos, to use that analogy. When we start to let go of these things, however fearful it may be at the time in meditation, we begin to experience a kind of freshness, at least this is my experience, a freshness of just meeting the conditions in our lives and other beings just as they are. And this is something in my experience that is always renewed and always renewable. It is never lost. It is never... It never grows stale. We may feel that staleness from time to time, but if we examine what we're clinging to, what we're holding on to, we find it again. So in the just sitting practice that we do, and as that grows faith, we find more and more that we can discern better what is good to do, what sort of views that really work, really help, and we can just let go of all the old stuff that really we don't need and that really prevents us from realizing our potential in this life and our purpose for living. So I've certainly observed how my mind can throw up countless reasons for not doing things in the past. You know, I come to something, an opportunity that's given to me, and the old kind of, you know, record starts playing, and, oh no, I can't do that. I've got all this other stuff to do first. I couldn't do that. Or, you know, however it might play out. Or one is just, you know, terror-struck, temporarily thinking, no, I'm not capable of that. And then later realizing, gosh, how foolish, you know. I remember Reverend Master Geo offering me a job once as a senior officer many years ago. It was a bit of a difficult time for me, but I think she recognized I was probably going through something that was ultimately, you know, probably quite good, but I didn't see that, and I turned her down, you know, and later I thought, gee whiz, you know, that was not that so much I wanted the position as she was seeing something about me, and I think she did this with all of her disciples. She saw a potential in us. She saw the Buddha nature. She knew what we were capable of, and offered it all the time, you know, and we foolishly... turned her down quite a bit. I did, anyway. But I woke up after a while, thanks to the refuge of the Sangha and continuing to meditate and finding that freshness and realizing, oh, seeing that she was actually trusting me. She was actually helping me to move on. And then I did take that leap, fortunately, and continued to follow her. But it's really good to examine these things. And we all have these opportunities in our life, whether they manifest in our work or in relationships or in our studies, just to look at carefully what we're doing that holds us back. I found that in going straight on and not believing in the self-opinions, it's almost like a sort of background noise sometimes that's there that we're so used to, that gradually it loses its power over us and we're less burdened and we're more able to just do what needs to be done. I think it's quite miraculous, really, how this meditation works, or so I felt on occasion. It's also very ordinary and very down-to-earth and very, very doable. So, you know, the miracle of the ordinary. Nothing wrong with having views, of course, and being engaged with good causes and so on, just that these become a problem if we're acting out of a sense of selfish self or a sense of being separate from the eternal Buddha nature. When these views and opinions go against the grain of the precepts, we can help use the Dharma to help us to see what is good to go with and what is good not to go with. Another way that they can be harmful, our opinions, is when we're comparing ourselves with others too much. You know, of course, it's good to look at the virtues of others and to appreciate them and to be willing to emulate them and so on. But if we are using that to compare and create opinions about ourselves being inferior or superior or whatever it might be, then they become harmful. Again, these can be very subtle. Sometimes our opinions and views sort of have become, for many of us, sort of the basis for our sense of self-worth. You know, we belong to something, or lots of people agree with us, and we begin to believe that's who we are. And when that starts to fall apart a bit, you know, we're ill or something changes or we lose a job or something, it can be quite devastating. We realize, oh, that's not who I really am, and it can be kind of scary. So the sooner we meditate, the sooner we learn to let go of these things and live from what seems good and true as a result of the meditation, the better off we are, the better we are able to meet the conditions that life presents us. I know with regards to opinions, just in the last week, 10 days, as you probably have noticed, a lot of our monks are away. I think altogether about 8 or 9 of our monks are in the UK and England at our monastery, Throstlehold Buddhist Abbey, for every 2 years we have a gathering of our order. And our abbess, vice abbot, and many of our senior monks are there, participating in the gathering, monastic gathering, as Rav Master Shiko mentioned last week. And, you know, we talk about things pertaining to our monastic training, to ourselves as a community, as an order, and all sorts of issues that I'm sure we'll be hearing about eventually, things of importance to us, and also just an opportunity to come together. Families don't stay together unless they see each other now and then. And the monks here, the senior monks here, have kindly had the opportunity from the head of the order as a gift, really, to us to listen to those discussions now. Modern technology makes it very easy to be able to download things, right? So we've been able to listen to them. And I've found this to be a very interesting practice because I'm not there and I can't put my 2 bits in when it comes up, you know. And, of course, we've been invited to put our 2 bits in if we want to, separately by email. But nonetheless, really good practice. And I know in my life I've tended to either just not be involved, in other words, think, okay, I don't need to say anything, I don't need to get in there, I'll just sit back and watch everything and withdraw. Or once I'm, you know, invited to say something, I'm in there, you know. And there's, again, coming in terms of letting go of extremes, I find that a real practice to find a balance there. Do I really need to say something? Is it good to say something? Yes, I think it is. Or could I just sit still and listen, you know? So when we have our meetings, that's an ongoing training for me. And in this case, there I am listening, hours of listening to discussion. And it's been really helpful because it's caused me to listen more deeply and to watch the little head of opinion that pokes up and examine it, you know. And after some examination, a few thoughts that may seem worth, you know, passing on do keep coming up, and I put those down and distill them. but the process has been wonderful. So it makes me think, gosh, listening, equanimity, being still and just taking in and allowing oneself to be part of something bigger without putting oneself forth or withdrawing oneself, for that matter, is an art and is a wonderful thing. So that is one way that I've been practicing this of late, and I'm sure some of the others have too. So at this time of equal light and darkness, I gather astronomically it's roughly equal, okay? Nothing's perfect. But also it brings to mind for me, as I mentioned, the opportunity to more easily cultivate and deepen the practice of equanimity, and I mean equanimity with a capital E. Again, as I mentioned, something that I felt a strong need to work on of late in my training. And I looked up equanimity in the dictionary, and it says it means mental calmness, composure, and evenness of temper, especially in a difficult situation. And I thought, okay. And actually also found out that the term comes from early 17th century English, which also has the connotation of fairness and impartiality. And it comes from the Latin equanimitas, which is, well, equus is equal and animus is mind. So equal mind, I rather like that. So that I picked up that theme a bit. Equal mind, equal night. A very helpful idea. In the Buddhist teaching, equanimity is comes from the Pali upekkha, and it's one of the four sublime or divine abodes, also referred to as the four boundless states. And in our tradition, in the Zen traditions, often one more often hears them referred to as the four immeasurables. So they're really big. The other three being loving-kindness, metta, compassion, karuna, and sympathetic joy, mudita. And that's a huge subject. I'm not going to go into all of those now, but I, in reflecting on it, I felt that in one sense it's rather like our precepts, where focusing on any one of them and looking at it carefully will open you to the others as well. There, you know, any one of those is a gateway to all of them. There's no way you can't end up with loving kindness, compassion, and sympathetic joy if you're really practicing equanimity, which is very reassuring because, again, my little mind says, oh my God, this is so big. How could I ever, you know, do all of that? My little Buddhist dictionary says that equanimity is an ethical quality of training and should not be confused with, quote, indifferent feeling, which is also sometimes called upekkha. So I think this is a very interesting point, because when we hear the term equanimity, we can have all these ideas of, and I've had a lot of misconceptions about it, you know, my imagination sees me being totally cool just in every situation, right? Never disturbed, unruffled. I can take anything. And when I was early, a young monk here, we had this lovely quote that was put on a plaque, I think from one of our great ancestors, Japanese ancestors, Manzando Haku. And it was, what was it? If you really want to know the truth, you must become an iron man. And I really like that. Of course, I didn't get stuck with the male part of it. It's just an iron person or an iron trainee or an iron woman. But the point being, that kind of solidity and equanimity, right? And I still have that on my wall. It's always been important to me. However, I've had some misconceptions about what that means throughout my life, and they've caused me some serious problems. Maybe I'll be able to save somebody else a bit of grief. It's a quality of training. It doesn't mean, of course, becoming uncaring or without feeling or cold of heart. It doesn't mean you become some sort of superhuman person that you don't interact with others or your environment, of course. I that sounds a little extreme, but people do suffer from that. You know, I'm the guest master here now, and other guest masters know this too. we see all sorts of questions and conditions, you know, that come with people who come to train here. And it's not an uncommon thing that people are looking for that kind of strength, but they often feel that they have to do it somehow in isolation, you know. So that's not what equanimity is about. And I mean, we learn about that if we just keep going. It's quite human to suffer from that. It has, for me, more to do with... it partakes more of sympathy, stillness in the midst of all conditions, I've discovered, not being blown about by the eight winds, gain and loss, fame and disgrace, and so on. And again, involves, as I mentioned, an ability to listen and hear more deeply. Perhaps fearlessness in the real sense of what that means, even in the midst of feeling anxious or worried. Maybe a bit like a Achalanatha over there, becoming immovable amid the passions of greed, anger, and delusion, yet also flexible of mind and heart. And the sympathetic part is an important part of it. I see it as an openness where we're not clinging to the old stuff, the opinions and so on, but we're able to allow things to sort of pass through unhindered so that we can be more at one with the truth of all beings and of all situations. Make use of that for ourselves and others, if that makes sense. I hope I'm making sense. And you can all still hear me? Yeah? Okay. Good. I'm going to read a little story that perhaps illustrates the quality of equanimity that you've heard probably many times, but I'll just we'll talk about this one. There's an old Chinese Taoist story of an old farmer who had worked his crops for many years. You've heard this one. And one day his horse ran away. And upon hearing the news, his neighbors came to visit and said, "Such bad luck. I'm so sorry," they said sympathetically. "Maybe," the farmer replied. The next morning, the horse returned, bringing with it three other wild horses. "How wonderful," the neighbors exclaimed. "Maybe," replied the old man. And the following day, his son tried to ride one of the untamed horses, was thrown off the horse, and broke his leg. And the neighbors again came to offer their sympathy on his misfortune. "Maybe," answered the farmer. One wonders whether he could be that cool about it, but nonetheless, we get the point. We get the point. The day after that, military officials came to the village to draft young men into the army. Seeing that the son's leg was broken, they passed him by. The neighbors congratulated the farmer on how well things had turned out. He was able to keep his son. And of course, some people might not consider that a good thing. They might consider it a misfortune. But nonetheless, the farmer replied again, "Maybe." A very famous old story. And it does show something of the mind of equanimity. And of course, we're not all going to go around saying maybe to everything that everybody says. Become incredibly tiresome people if we do that, and boring. And, at the same time, perhaps there's something wonderful in that story for me, because it does point to a kind of stillness and passionlessness in terms of attachment to my, you know, personal preference for how things will work out, because those are always going to get knocked around, you know, as we go through life. And perhaps points to a way that we can meet conditions in life with greater equanimity and acceptance and compassion. And also, frankly, wasting less time, making use of what's there, you know. So... it does not, however, it can be misunderstood, again, this kind of story, to mean that, it's all just fine. It's all good. You know that expression, it's all good? It's one of those ones that I hear it and I say, yeah, and... or what's the other one? It's meant to be. Yeah, and... We do have choices, and sometimes we don't feel so good. Yet on one level, it is all good. On another level, sometimes we have to make it good, you know. There's our part in that, if that makes sense. Anyway, I liked that story. I'm going to just read a little passage here from Reverend Master Jiu's commentary. This is in Roar of the Tigers, Volume 2. on her commentary on Dogen's chapter, Kayin Zammai, The Great Ocean of Meditation. She says, "It's very humbling to realize how great the design of the universe is, because it is not fully comprehensible by any of us. But one can have some glimpse of the colossal size of it and of how important and benevolent it actually is." And perhaps we experience some of that, don't we, when we look at the stars and the moon and consider the cosmos at this time of year. Yes, all the suffering does go on an individual level, or so it seems, and so long as our faith stays true, we can help that suffering by staying within the third position. That does not mean that we become cold-hearted. She refers to the third position, beyond the opposites of clinging to the extremes. That does not mean that we become cold-hearted. It doesn't mean that we become non-compassionate. It doesn't mean we can't grieve. The Zen master can both grieve and cry, but his grief does not overwhelm him so that he is incapable of acting, because he himself or she is rooted in faith and meditation. And the same can be true of every monk and every lay trainee. If you are rooted in faith and living in the third position, i.e. as best you can from your Buddha nature, your true nature, the divine abodes, then when the horrors of stupidity and ignorance come, you will not be overwhelmed by the suffering. Instead, you will want to renew your own efforts, both at helping and strengthening your own faith and in helping and strengthening the faith of others. I thought that was a really helpful passage in clarifying further what equanimity is and what it's not. We recently saw a film about the life of D.T. Suzuki, and some of you came here and watched it with us. Really good, I thought, really good film. And you probably all have heard of D.T. Suzuki. And it's called Zen. I think you can even get it on YouTube if you're interested in it. Some of his disciples, they interviewed a lot of his disciples. And one thing that stuck out in my mind was one of his disciples talking about how they were asking him about what was so great about Satori or Kensho or, you know, awakening experience, awakening to the truth. What was so great about that? You know, what was different after you had that kind of experience or after you'd been training for some time? What was different? And I think this came up because he had lost his wife, you know, after his wife died quite a long time before he died. He was grieving quite deeply for quite some time. And they were sort of looking at him, you know, and this has happened to Reverend Master Ji. It happens to every you know, Buddhist teacher or Zen master. You know, you're just being very human. You know, what about your enlightenment experience? Where's that, you know? Where does that come in? And they said, he said, "Yes, I'm grieving." They said, "What's the difference? What's the difference after Satori?" And he said, "The difference is that my grief doesn't have roots." Yeah. And I thought that was really great. I think someone mentioned that at a talk recently, but it's a really helpful point. We do experience grief. Equanimity doesn't mean we don't feel things. Probably we feel them in some ways more intensely, but they don't shake us. They don't shake us up so much. And in that way, we're more capable of sympathy and compassion, but we're just able to let it come up and let it flow through and let it pass. But it doesn't have the roots. It doesn't cause us perhaps to be uprooted from our sitting place. And at the same time, it passes and it allows us to move on. So I think that's an important distinction to keep in mind. I certainly have had, we've all had losses in our lives, so we can relate to that. And just recently, and right at the present time, in fact, my cat, Nanki Poo, has been quite ill with kidney failure and is dying gradually. And, you know, he's 18 and he's had a good life and he's doing pretty well. And I'm taking care of him as best I can. But he's been teaching me so much through this experience, I've been realizing in these last few weeks, because I You know, I notice myself whenever he does want to eat something, I get all excited. Oh, he's eating, great, he's eating. And then he goes through a period where he doesn't want to eat, and I'm, oh, he's like, what can I do? I'm not doing enough, da 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 da, you know. And I was sort of, you know, running myself a bit ragged with this. And realizing, okay, you know, something was pointing me to a deeper place. I finally started to enter that, and it's a very beautiful kind of acceptance of the situation. And I was able to see more of the dignity with which he's going through all of this, the affection, the gratitude that he has for his life as a cat in a monastery, and all of that. So I'm now able to be with him more in that process, in a different place. Now, it doesn't mean that I'm not happy when he eats and I cooch him more when he doesn't and all that. It doesn't mean I don't feel that. But just noticing how my mind can go off with these things and how we can run ourselves ragged, as I said. It's been a really wonderful teaching. So as Reverend Master, as we started out with, Reverend Master teaching us that, you know, everything is teaching us. So if we just let go of our preferences, our ideas of how it should be, we see the Dharma right there in these situations that we're encountering, really every day, actually, you know, in our environment, the planets, each other, etc. One of the things she mentions was it's an easier time to move from worldly thinking or worldliness to more deeply leading the religious life. And what does that actually mean? I guess one way that we might think of as worldly, being worldly, is that can be misunderstood. It doesn't mean people living in the world or lay people, or it doesn't mean any of that. It means when there's attachment to a separate self, and when we're stuck with selfishness in a way, that's worldliness. Yeah, the religious life, it may not look like religion at all. It doesn't even have to refer to religion. Sometimes, you know, but it's to do with that openness of heart and stillness of mind and heart that is able to learn from every situation, able to make use of it, able to be to point others to their true nature as well, and able to not be so thrown by the hurts and the offenses that we experience in our daily life. I'll read you one little example here that I thought was kind of a nice story. I was looking at some stories of the Buddha's disciples, which I'm very fond of. And there's one here of in the Dhammapada. We all know about the Dhammapada. And all the Buddha's little teachings and verses are based on, often he gave some teaching after some incident happened with his disciples, right? So the Dhammapada comes out of that. This one's called, Like the Earth, Arahants Resent Not. He says, the Buddha says, like the earth, a balanced and well-disciplined person resents not. He is comparable to an Indakila, that's a pillar, like a temple pillar. He's comparable to a temple pillar. Like a pool, unsullied by mud, is he, or she. Remember that it's got nothing to do with males or females here. To such a balanced one, life's wanderings do not arise, do not pull him or her off. So the story that goes with this is, here we have inadvertently the Venerable Shariputra, who was one of the Buddha's chief disciples, brushed against the ear of a monk who was jealous of him. The latter, Shariputra, the jealous monk reported this unconscious discourtesy to the Buddha. And actually, in some versions of this story, you know, he complained that he had abused him. Questioned by the Buddha about the incident, the Venerable Shariputra, without asserting his innocence, described his humble ways ever since he became a monk. Described his training, basically, ever since he became a monk, and his intentions. Remorse overtook the erring monk, who now implored pardon from the Venerable Shariputra, who in his turn sought pardon from him if he had done any wrong. The Buddha extolled the Venerable Shariputra, comparing him to the unresenting earth. So, you know, obviously a lofty example, but one that is doable. He was as human as we are, and capable of, could have gone the other way. It's something we can train ourselves into. Another little example of equanimity, this one's called Unshaken as a Rock. The Buddha's verse is, as a solid rock is unshaken by the wind, even so the wise are unshaken by praise or blame. This is about a monk called Badiya. He was one of the bhikkhus, one of the monks staying at the Jetavana monastery. Because of his short figure, he was known as Lakuntaka, the dwarf. Lakuntaka, Badiya, was very good-natured. Even young monks would often tease him. This is a male monastery, obviously. Would often tease him by pulling his nose or his ear or by patting him on his head. Very often they would jokingly say, "Uncle, how are you? Are you happy? Are you bored with your life here as a monk?" Badiya never retaliated in anger or abused them. In fact, he was very serene and pleasing to the eyes. When told about the patience of Badiya, the Buddha said, an arahant, one who has fully awakened to his true nature, to things as they are, an arahant never loses his temper. He has no desire to speak harshly or think ill of others. He's like a mountain of solid rock. Thus, the Iron Man, that's what it's about, iron person. As a solid rock is not shakable by wind, so also an arahant is unperturbed by scorn or by praise. Only then did the other monks come to know that actually Badiya had attained sainthood. You know, they didn't realize. You know, again, just a nice example. Very doable. And we could probably insert for each of us any of our, whatever it is, our condition, our shortcoming, things that we've been teased about. I still have memories of being teased terribly by my younger brothers when I was the oldest sister of seven. And it's only in recent years we've had a chance to talk about it and laugh about it. But I wasn't very patient when I was a teenager, and my brother would come up and tease me when I was peeling potatoes and they got to play. But, you know, now I'm grateful for that. I learned to be responsible at an early age. Not that I was always responsible in my life. And we've had a good laugh about it. Now, you know, it's again a teaching we can take into our older part of our life. You know, we don't have to throw potatoes at our family if they're giving us a hard time. Anyway, we all have our stories like that, but it's good to know that it's doable. This isn't something that, you know, happens in the next life. We can do it in this life. So, that's enough, I think, but I'm going to end with this little story about another example. These are just examples. You may all have heard of Nyogen Senzaki, who is no longer alive, died in 1959, but was a very great Zen teacher in this country. Spent a lot of time in America, and long story short, he, struggled a lot just to survive, but also was interred in, you know, the camps in which they this country put Japanese people during World War II, towards the end of World War II, and he happened to be living, I think, at was it Heart Mountain in Wyoming? Is that Wyoming? Yeah. So he was a very great teacher, very humble person, wrote some beautiful poems, and there's some transcriptions of Dharma talks in this book called Like a Dream, Like a Fantasy. I don't know if this is all of his works, but it's quite interesting if you're interested. Like a Dream, Like a Fantasy, Nyogen Senzaki. Here's one about Heart Mountain. When he was living there in January 1, 1943, morning haze gives an illusion of California. He was living in California previous to being, transported there. The east wind promises the coming of spring. Within the snow-covered plateau of internment, evacuees can go no place else. They can admire only the gorgeous sunrise, beyond the barbed wire fence, above the hills and mountains. But he was able to see beyond the situation. He was able to practice equanimity. Here's New Year's Day, 1944. There's nothing more auspicious than the rising sun on New Year's Day in the exiled life. Within 100 miles of this naked desert, not a thing comes to sight. 10,000 Japanese are here as American guests. What are they enjoying in the day? No one knows but themselves. A spring breeze, sorry, this always makes me cry. A spring breeze of laughter swings out from each cell. Well, there you go. And those were difficult times. No, they happened on all sides of the fence, these difficult times, of course. But he had a way of expressing how to get beyond it and yet to be fully in it. So I'll end with one of my absolute favorite poems of his, which is very famous and many of you have heard. This is after he was released and is now living in Los Angeles. He was managing a hotel and lived out his life having to work really hard just to make a living. Meanwhile, teaching Zen students, writing poems, and of course has a wonderful legacy. It's called Alone on New Year's Day, 1946. Like a snail, I carry my humble Zendo with me. It is not as small as it looks, for the boundless sky joins it when I open a window. If one has no idea of limitation, he should enjoy real freedom. A nameless monk may not have New Year's callers to visit him, but the morning sun hangs above the slums. This is in Los Angeles. It will be honorable enough to receive the golden light from the east. And that's the light of the eternal coming from the east. It's always thought to come from the east. And just as the raised suns are hitting us equally in these next few days, let us allow those rays to reflect, if you like, come to the next holiday, the moon of our original nature. We'll have a full moon towards the end of the week so we can allow that to reflect, as Nyogen Senzaki did.